Okay, so our topic for tonight is the rabbis come to America, the 1840s. As we've discussed over the past many weeks, the early American Jewish communities were not served by real rabbis who were ordained with smicha, with yadin yadin or yore yore in the traditional sense, but rather they were served by chazanim of limited Judaic knowledge, who did the best they could, despite lacking the credentials and the halachic learning. And for serious questions, if there were any, sometimes they would have to be passed off to the chief rabbis in London, or simply not answered at all, or answered on a whim by people who were not really competent. But the rabbis do make it to America. The first one to show up on the scene and to serve a congregation was Abraham Rice. Abraham Rice, Avraham Rice, was born in 1800, in Germany, in Bavaria, and he studied in the Würzburg Yeshiva, was given smicha by Avram Bing, so this is a real rabbi with real credentials, and even led his own yeshiva for some time in Germany in the 1830s. And then he moved to America in 1840. Why? Not entirely clear, but it wasn't so easy to sustain a pulpit in Germany for traditional rabbis around that time because the various kehilot were moving in a reformist direction. Not that America was going to be any better, but sometimes you seek your fortune or your future across the pond. And he went to Newport, Rhode Island. He thought that maybe he could revive what had once been a glorious community of Newport, but after the revolution had basically died. And he found that he couldn't do anything there. So he quickly moved to Baltimore. And in Baltimore, he became the rabbi of the Baltimore Hebrew congregation, which was the Stadtschule, the chief synagogue in town. It was known as Congregation Nidchei Yisrael, the Dispersed of Israel. While in Baltimore, he fought to the best of his ability to sustain Shabbos and Kashrus. Now, this is an important thing for rabbis of a traditional bent when they're in a community that is not grounded in long-standing traditions. If this is a new kehila, and especially in America, everything is new. So the people are not bound by old traditions. And in a changing world, even the essentials of Judaism are going to fall by the boards. Not because people have an ideological vision of a reformed Judaism necessarily, but rather just indifference, religious indifference. And Shabbos and Kashrus is hard to do in America. So he tries his best to keep it going. He opposes any reforms of the liturgy. He wants to maintain all the piyutim, so he wouldn't have liked the Rosh Hashanah davening we all had yesterday. No piyutim. He did not want to give aliyot to someone who isn't Shomer Shabbos. Well, that's a bit of a problem, because what happens if the bulk of your congregants are no longer Sabbath observance in the technical halachic sense? What are you going to do? People want to get aliyot. You have to give aliyot. So what's going to happen? He was forced to back down by the authority of the layman's board. The lay leadership of the synagogue, the board of directors, they said, no, you have to let people have aliyot irrespective of their irreligiosity. But he had a backup plan. He said, fine, the Mechallel Shabbos will get aliyahs, but I'll tell the traditional Jews in the congregation not to say amen to the bracha. So we were like a stick a finger in their eye. No amen to your bracha. The progressives were winning the day, and it wasn't going to be possible for Abraham Rice to hold out. Now, the real progressive types, who were totally dissatisfied with the traditional rabbinate and wanted freedom of movement in the religious sense, in 1842 broke away and established the Har Sinai Verein. Verein meaning a German word for a club or association. Har Sinai. By the way, why would a reformist group emphasize Har Sinai as opposed to any other kind of name for their congregation? So who wants to unmute themselves and tell me?
Biblical.
Biblical, and especially what? The Ten Commandments. So people who are dissatisfied with attempts to preserve the nitty-gritty of Rabbinic Judaism, or even for that matter of Biblical Judaism, but want simply the moralistic aspects of Biblical Judaism, they will emphasize the Decalogue. And the Decalogue is Ten Commandments, Har Sinai. So, Har Sinai Verein.
Are they speaking English or German?
Okay, they're speaking German, But as the years go by, more and more they will switch to English. So the early arrivals in the 1830s and 40s are definitely speaking German. The rabbis are going to begin to preach in English probably starting in the 1850s, but German will continue as late as the 1870s in some congregations. So it's a slow process, each synagogue at its own pace. But between the 1840s and 1870s, you move away from German towards English. Okay. Rice collaborated with Isaac Leiser, our hero from last week's session, in writing for the Occident. And Rice wanted to establish a Beit Din with himself at the head in order to strengthen Judaism. Remember, you need a Beit Din for certain halakhic functions, whether divorce or conversion or adjudication of disputes. And he, being the only qualified rabbi, felt that the formation of an American Beit Din would go a long way to sustain certain aspects of Judaism, and otherwise we'll just die. Okay. But, as I said, the community was moving away from his traditionalism. And in 1849, he resigned his post as the rabbi of Nidchei Yisrael. He decided to go into the dry goods business and to open a grocery store to make a parnassa. But you couldn't make a parnassa as a rabbi because the people are not listening to the rabbis, at least not the traditional ones. So if you insisted upon maintaining your religious scruples and did not want to capitulate to the wishes of the masses, you had to get out of the rabbinate as a profession and do something else to earn your daily bread. His friends, who were the traditionalists, decided to open up a shul in which he could be the leader, but he wouldn't get paid for his services. So there was a small little Orthodox shtiebel under his auspices. In 1862, shortly before his death, Nidchei Yisrael called him back on the promise that the shul would remain entirely Orthodox. And for a few months, he was the rabbi, and then he died later in 1862. But Nidchei Yisrael, by 1871, had an organ and mixed pews and went totally Reform. Debbie's iPad is asking me, how proficient were the early immigrant rabbis in the English language? The answer is, some of them never learned it properly, and others made a point of becoming fluent as quickly as possible. The two who I have in mind are Isaac Meir Wise and Max Lilienthal, who we'll discuss tonight, who became quality preachers in the English language. Okay. The next rabbi I want to talk about is the other rabbi who maintained his orthodoxy and his traditionalism, and that was Bernard Illouy, or Yisachar Dov Illouy. He was born in 1814, died in 1871. He was born in Bohemia and was ordained by the Chassam Sofer. So you can't get better than a smicha from the Chassam Sofer in the Pressburg Yeshiva. But he also had a PhD from Budapest. So he had credentials Judaically and secularly. It's very important to have both. He was a great orator in many languages, in many European languages. He could not get a job in Europe. And the reason he could not get a job in Europe, despite his Judaic and secular credentials, is because he supported the revolutions of 1848. And that's a big no-no, because when the revolution doesn't win, when they fail, and you were known as being part of the losing team, well, that doesn't go very well for you. He opposed the existence of the Habsburg monarchy, and so it was impossible in the Austro-Hungarian Empire for him to get a job. Therefore, he had no choice but to move to America. But he was a little bit of an irascible guy, and so he bounced around. He first was in New York City, then he went to Syracuse, then Philadelphia, then Baltimore, then St. Louis, then New Orleans, all in the span of 20 years. The fact that he bounced around so much means he couldn't stay put in one place because he couldn't come to terms with a kahila. They were always at loggerheads. He hated Reform, and in 1855, he promoted the Cleveland Conference. We're going to discuss this tonight at some length. The Cleveland Conference of 1855 was an attempt at gathering together all the Jewish clergymen in America in support of Yiddishkeit. But this gathering was going to include people who were on various parts of the theological spectrum. And it's not easy to gather together people who don't agree with each other on all theological points. It's going to lead to certain compromises by one side or the other. Well, at first he promoted this conference, but once he realized it was not going to bolster tradition the way he thought tradition should be bolstered in a truly Orthodox fashion, he never bothered to attend. He supported the Confederacy, And this is going to be an issue that we're going to have to deal with over the next few weeks. The role of the Jewish community in the Civil War and the role of the rabbis regarding slavery in the Civil War. Illui was serving in Baltimore, which is a southern city, despite being not in the Confederacy, it's a southern city by sentiment. And he also served in St. Louis and New Orleans, where there is southern sentiment. And he believed that the Confederacy was a just cause because it protected property rights, whereas the Union was looking to strip people of their property rights. Okay. So his one famous thing for posterity was that he halachically forbidden a certain type of bird, the Muscovy duck, which today in Israel is considered kosher, was for many years in the United States and by the OU considered not kosher because of Illui's ruling in America 150 years ago. Okay. Illui was a little bit full of himself, and maybe rightfully so, because he actually was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer and was a Talmud Chacham Gamur. He really wrote Shilas and Shuvas. He said there are 200 shuls in America and there are three real rabbis, and of the three real rabbis, I'm the smartest. So when you have that attitude, it's not going to be easy to get along with everybody. Okay. Now let's go to those who did not sustain their traditionalism as the years went on. Well, one of them is Leo Merzbacher. Leo Merzbacher was born in 1810 and died a relatively young man in 1856 at the age of 46. He was also given, not necessarily smicha by the Chasam Sofer, but was given the title of Morenu. So it might not have been Hatarat Torah, like Yore Yore or Yadin Yadin, but he got some honorific title for his learning from the Chasam Sofer, from the Pressburg Yeshiva. He moved to America in 1841 and had an affiliation with Rodef Shalom, which was one of the German congregations. In 1843, he moved on to Anshei Chesed. And in 1845, he moved on to the Kultusverein Emmanuel, which was a reform-minded cultural association which became Congregation Emmanuel of New York City in 1845. And at first, his reforms were moderate, but they would evolve over time. He wrote a Seder Tefillah. Moshe says, was the Chasam Sofer a supporter of students' migration to America? The answer is no, but he also died in 1839 before any of his students did. So if you're looking for a Rav and a Rosh Yeshiva, a Godel in Europe who favored immigration to America, you have to go later in the century to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the Rav of Kovno in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. He favored immigration to America because he said American Jews need Rabbanim. And the Agudas Rabbanim was largely his Talmidim in the first part of the 20th century. Okay, so Merzbacher writes a liturgy called Seder Tefillah. It was fairly traditional. There was a lot of Hebrew in it, but there was some German poems and some English as well. At first, Emmanuel had separate seating and people wore hats. Of course, that would change over time. The yarmulke would disappear, the hat would disappear, and the seating would be mixed when they would build their large house of worship on 12th Street. But the founders were young German Jews who had a little bit of enlightenment with them before they got to America. So they came a little bit later than the earliest wave. And they were dissatisfied with the thoroughgoing orthodoxy and traditionalism of the early Ashkenazic synagogues of New York. The first Ashkenazic synagogue in New York was B'nai Jeshvan in 1825, but other ones were established in the late 1830s and early 1840s, and they tended to be orthodox in character, at least at first. Of course, none of them would remain that way. But Emmanuel is a conscious attempt at departing from that in favor of reform. Merzbacher was their rabbi, although he was on thin ice in terms of his relationship with the board as well. He died in 1856, a year after his prayer book was released, and his prayer book never really took off. There were other competitive prayer books that would become much more popular because their authors would live to tell the story. Okay, so now let's go to the two rabbis, or pseudo-rabbis, who I wanted to spend most of the time on tonight. Let's go to Max Lilienthal. So Max Lilienthal was born in Munich, was ordained as a rabbi in the German yeshivas, and received a PhD. So he had the secular and the Judaic rabbinic credentials. But he was a maskil. Now, a maskil doesn't necessarily mean an apikoris gomer, or like a shegetz or a heretic. It just means someone with enlightenment. Okay, you could be an orthodox maskil. And at first, his maskilic tendencies brought him to Riga in Latvia, where he was going to run a maskilic school. Bear in mind that in the Baltic countries, there was a heavy Germanic influence, especially in Latvia, but even in Lithuania, to be honest. And there were those so-called Eastern European Jews who were maskilim in nature and were willing to accept help from German maskilim in educating their offspring, educating their children. So Lilienthal goes to Latvia to run a school. He comes across Sergei Yuvanov, who is Tsar Nicholas I's minister for national enlightenment. And Yuvanov decides that he wants to hire Lilienthal as his Jew expert. And the goal is for Lilienthal to establish maskilic schools all throughout the Pale of Settlement, all throughout Jewish Eastern Europe under Tsarist control. Well, Lilienthal, you know, is very excited about this job opportunity. He's 26 years old. This is a big job. He's being given by the government of Russia. And so he's all gung-ho about it. He wants to transform backward Russian Jews of the shtetl, of the Pale, and make them enlightened Westerners. Oh, sounds like a good idea. Well, the Jews of the Pale had not been consulted. And they didn't want Lilienthal, some phony baloney rabbi without a beard who speaks languages other than Yiddish. They thought he was might as well be a shegetz. So they're not interested in his services. Moreover, they understand, they comprehend that Lilienthal has been duped by the Russian government. That Tsar Nicholas I had a missionary approach towards the Jews, a conversionary approach. He hated the Jews with a passion and wanted some to die, some to leave, some to convert to Russian Orthodoxy, and that these schools were going to be tools in the Christianizing of Jewish youth. But Lilienthal didn't understand that. He thought, oh, the Russian government just wants to make the Jews more modern and not as backward. Well, he was duped. So in 1844, after 3 years at work for the Russians, Lilienthal runs out of the country. He hightails it out of there. It's not entirely clear why he left. In the Chabad folklore, it is claimed that Lilienthal was misappropriating money and that the Nicholas I regime got wind of it and wanted to prosecute him, and so he ran away lest he face a jail sentence. But it's not surprising that Chabad would claim that, because Chabad in general hates secular education and certainly did not want some Westerner interfering in the life of traditional Jewry. The alternative is Lilienthal came to understand that what he thought was l'shem shamayim and a good thing for Am Yisrael is actually bad for the Jews, that you couldn't trust the Russian government, and this was not in the Jews' best interest. Okay, so Lilienthal runs away from Europe and comes to America. He arrives in America in 1845. New York City, and there are no real rabbis in New York City. There are some preachers at Congregation Shari Chesed. You had Samuel Isaacs, who was a reverend, who had some Jewish learning, but was not really a rabbi. The question is this the contemporary of the Cantonists? Yes, this does overlap with the Cantonist system of the Nicholas I. It was a very rough time. It would get better a little bit under Alexander II after 1855. But yes, it was a very bad time when the choppers were grabbing the Jewish boys. Okay, so Lilienthal comes to New York. There are no real rabbis. And he's hired by a consortium of German congregations to be the chief rabbi of the German Jewish community of New York. So Shari Shamayim, Anshei Chesed, and Rodev Shalom, sometimes known as St. Rodef's, well, that's now, not then, hired him as the chief rabbi, and he was supposed to darsh sermons at various synagogues at various times and oversee religious life, whether kashrus or other halachic issues. So what Lilienthal wants to do is establish a Beit Din. Again, everyone has this idea, a Beit Din, ecclesiastical hierarchy will be a good idea for the community. And so in 1846, he establishes one together with the new arrival, Isaac Meir Wise, who we'll speak about soon enough, and a few underlings who didn't really have smicha. Okay, so Lilienthal at first is a thoroughgoing traditionalist. He believes in decorum and wants a dignified service, but let it be what we might call a modern Orthodox service. He was by no means a Reform rabbi in 1845-6-7 in America. But as with seemingly all of his colleagues, he can't get along with the lay leadership of his various synagogues. And on one occasion, he refused to go be the 10th man in a minyan in one of the three shuls because he didn't want to leave a board meeting at the other shul because he didn't want to miss the juicy part of the board meeting because he didn't trust the lay people not to boss him around or do things behind his back. So because he missed minyan and they didn't get a 10th man, so the board was broigus with him and they wanted him to apologize and he wouldn't apologize. There was not a good relationship at that point. In 1848, he left the rabbinate. He resigned his position from the three shuls and he established the Jewish day school instead. He ran for the next 6 years a Jewish day school. But to Lilienthal's credit, he was not so over the top and overbearing in his pomposity. He maintained a decent relationship with some of the shuls, and he didn't burn all of his bridges. So they invited him back to the high holidays to give sermons and to lead davening, which is a nice thing that you still didn't burn your bridges with your shuls. But in 1855. He decides to move on from New York and take a position in Cincinnati at B'nai Israel Synagogue. Why does he leave New York? Well, a few reasons. One, the air quality in New York was notoriously bad because the population was getting larger and larger, and New York City was not expanding geographically as rapidly as it might have been able to later on after they built the elevated trains. So air pollution is an issue. His wife had serious respiratory problems. And the doctors told him, go west. So Cincinnati seemed like an alternative to the densely populated New York. But there's another factor, and this is a very interesting one. Public schools. In America, you want your kid to get an education, so they go to school. But if the local schools are run by the church, whether actually the church or because the public schools have a Christian overtone and undertone and every tone, then if you're a Jewish parent, you don't want your kid going to that school. In New York City in 1855, they began having religiously neutral public schools run by whatever the Board of Education was called at that time. So if you're the CEO and founder of fill-in-the-blank Jewish day school where you're charging lots and lots of money of tuition, and all of a sudden the Jewish parents can get free public education where they're not going to sing the Lord's Prayer every day, then guess what? The day school is going to go out of business and the kids are going to go to public school. So that was a further reason why New York was no longer for him if he wasn't going to have a rabbinate position. Seth asks, in Germany, was there lay control of the rabbi's synagogues or was that an American innovation? So the answer is that the Kehillah did have a lot of authority over the rabbis in terms of hiring and firing. But the rabbis and the Beis Din had a very significant control over religious affairs, and there was a longstanding tradition of deferring to the rabbis in a lot of aspects of communal life, as opposed to in America, where there had been no rabbis. So the Amcha, the Hamonam, the masses, they run the show, the lay leadership. The fact that now there's a rabbi, he's an employee. Who's he to tell us what to do? So if we don't like what he's doing, he's fired. And if he wants to stand on ceremony, he's fired. Okay, so the rabbis really did not have the kind of authority that they had in Europe or that they would eventually have in America. Once the rabbinate becomes a respected profession in America with dozens or hundreds of rabbis operating, you know, dozens and hundreds of synagogues all over the country, which would be the case by the late 19th century. So then the rabbi and his rabbinical union will have a significant measure of authority. But before that happens, every rabbi is a man unto himself, bossed around by whoever pays the check. Okay. So Lilienthal goes to Cincinnati. He becomes the rabbi of Bnei Israel, which was the English-speaking congregation as opposed to the German-speaking congregation. And he collaborates with Isaac Meir Wise on his publication, The Israelite, which was a weekly newspaper. And later on, Lilienthal goes on to become one of the earliest professors, professor of Jewish history at Hebrew Union College after its establishment in 1875. So the irony here is the following. In 1845, Max Lilienthal came to New York as a gadol, a 30-year-old man with a PhD, with real smicha, real ordination, and was hired as the rabbi of three shuls, and was respected all over America, the American Jewish community, for his credentials and for his wisdom. Then, a year later, a little pishiker shows up, Isaac Meir Wise, 27 years old, whose credentials are dubious, and we'll discuss that in a second. He's a nobody from nothing, penniless. And Lilienthal sort of adopts Isaac Meir Wise under his wings and facilitates Wise getting his first pulpit in Albany, which we'll discuss in a second. But eventually, Isaac Meir Wise outpaces Lilienthal and becomes the Gadol Hador of American Reform Judaism. And Lilienthal becomes Wise's sidekick. So everyone wants to know Wise, how did this happen? After all, Wise didn't have the credentials that Lilienthal had, and Lilienthal looked good. Remember I said Isaac Leiser wasn't such a good-looking guy, and it hurt his career? So Lilienthal was like a distinguished-looking gentleman. Isaac Meir Wise was a repulsive-looking gentleman with a bad hair and a mustache, and it didn't look good, and glasses. And yet, he won out in the competition, if you want to say there was competition, for who becomes the great granddaddy of American reform. Okay, so now let's talk about Isaac Meir Wise, someone for whom I have not much respect and a lot of disdain. Of course, that's because of my own religious predilections and my own educational background. If I had gone to Hebrew Union College and if I was a reform rabbi, I'd think he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I don't. So who is Isaac Meir Wise? He was born in Bohemia in 1819, and he learned at Prague in a yeshiva for a little while, and he went to a university for a little while, but he did not have a university degree. He absolutely did not have a doctorate, and yet for his whole career, he was Dr. Wise. It was fake, completely fake. What about smicha, hatarat hora'ah? Real religious rabbinic ordination. Well, there are those who claim that he did receive Hatarat Hora'ah from Shlomo Yosef Rappaport, Shir, the chief rabbi of Prague, the maskilic yet orthodox chief rabbi of Prague, Shir, Rappaport. However, there's no evidence of this. And every attempt to secure evidence of his either doctorate or rabbinical diploma failed throughout the 19th century. So how did he get away with claiming that he was a rabbi and that he was a doctorate? How did he get away with it? Very simple. Who knows the answer? The answer is there's no internet. Okay, it's 1845. Who knows anything? You could claim whatever you want when you come across the ocean from Europe and say you're a big chacham and you have all sorts of degrees, but no one's going to know the difference. No one's going to know the difference. Asher says, enlightened rabbis in the 1840s coincide with the great idea of public education as a level in America. The process of assimilation. However, Christian influence continued into the mid-20th century until O'Hare Supreme Court striking down prayer in schools. That's right. So public schools were not absolutely friendly to Jews and Jewish religious scruples until the mid-20th century. However, as long as the religious indoctrination was tamped down enough so as to make your average Jewish parent comfortable sending their kid to the public school, that was problematic for sustaining parochial Jewish education. Until such time as you have parents who are really devoted to the cause of Yiddishkeit and want their kids to get a thoroughgoing Jewish education, that cannot be had in a Talmud Torah environment, which would not be until the 20th century. Okay. So, Isaac Mayer was, for 3 years, between 1843 and 1846, serves at Radnitz in Bohemia, in the Czech what become the Czech Republic. But he's not a rabbi, he's a teacher in the cheder. He's a malamed tinokos. He's teaching children in the cheder. He's not really a rabbi. But he arrives on July 23rd, 1846, and claims to be a clergyman. With the help of Max Lilienthal, Wise is able to secure a pulpit at Congregation Beth El in Albany. And while he's there in Albany, he makes some changes, some pretty serious changes. Number one, he counts women in a minyan. Okay? Now that's a very radical change to count women in a minyan. The conservative movement would not do that until 1973. All right? So that's a pretty big move. Also, he eliminated the bar mitzvah. In lieu of bar mitzvah, what other religious ceremony is there? Who knows? Who knows? Anybody? Confirmation. The point of Isaac Mayer Wise, a girl at the age of 12 and a boy at the age of 13 are too immature to understand the doctrines of the religion or to accept it wholeheartedly. Rather, you have to have further education, and maybe at 15 or 16, you can have confirmation. Also, he allowed a mixed choir. And when I say a mixed choir, I'm mixing who and who? What am I mixing in the choir? Who knows?
Men and women, or
Men
Jews
and
and
women.
non-Jews?
Okay, good. It could be either one. In this instance, it was men and women. Later on, it would be Jews and non-Jews. Okay. So, in 1848, Wise already has ideas about becoming the dominant figure in the American Jewish clergy. If in 1841 Isaac Leeser had attempted to have a union of Jewish congregations for the sake of strengthening Yiddishkeit, it failed because the various different types couldn't get along. In 1848, Wise says, no, let's try again. Have a union of congregations and have a union of clergymen and develop some kind of an ecclesiastical hierarchy that will then essentially boss around the union of congregations. So he wants union, but especially of the rabbis. There was a call for a meeting in 1849, but it never took place. So this was premature. Moshe is asking, counting women in a minyan due to necessity or supporting women's issues? So I don't think it was because of necessity. I think it was change for the sake of change. Change to prove that he could make change. And yes, he was a supporter of women's rights. Now, Asher says, confirmation smacks of Christian tradition. Isn't that the overbalance of Christianity on Jews wanting to be accepted? The answer is yes. Confirmation is very heavily influenced by Christianity. It's very un-Jewish, extremely un-Jewish. And Wise had to twist and turn some rabbinic texts and sources to try to prove the Judaic legitimacy of what really was a bogus innovation. Okay. So in 1850, Wise went down to Charleston. Now, if you recall, Charleston, Congregation Beit Elohim, had the episode of the Reformed Society of Israelites in the 1820s, and then had Gustavus Poznanski, who changed the shul to a Reform shul in the early 1840s, and that Sherith Israel was the Orthodox breakaway that was for the traditionalists who couldn't stomach Poznanski's changes. Well, Wise went down in 1850 to give a speech and to contest and contrast himself with Morris Raphael, who was a preacher who had just arrived from Birmingham in England and was hired at B'nai Yeshurun in New York and was a traditionalist preacher until his death in 1868. And so Wise got into a theological debate with Raphael as a guest speaker in Charleston, and he made some big, bold statements. He said, for example, I don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. Ani lo ma'amin b'tchiyat ha-meitim. He doesn't believe. And he says, I don't believe in the coming of the Messiah. So it's heresy, rank heresy. Of course, Beit Elohim are full of rank heretics. So they say, you're hired. We love you. You know, you're saying all sorts of apikorsis. Great, we love you. We'll hire you. And he almost took the job. But in the end, he didn't. He went back to his kahila in Albany temporarily. So Wise is willing to espouse radical theological positions because he thinks he can get away with it, and he thinks there's an audience for it, and he thinks he can steer even more people away from tradition with his bravado. So he goes back to his shul, Bethel of Albany, and they tell him, well, we found out what you said down in Charleston. And guess what? We don't want you to be our rabbi anymore. You know, you said things that we cannot accept, so you're not our rabbi anymore. Well, what happens when you get fired? What do? What should you do? Pack your bags and move away. What does he do instead?
He comes
on Rosh Hashanah, and he conducts the Shacharis service. Then they go up to the Aron to take out the Torah Ein Kamocha. They sing Sulzer's fancy Ein Kamocha in a high melody. And just as Wise is about to offer an English prayer, as the Torah is being taken out of the Ark, the president of the shul, a guy named Spanier, punches Wise, knocks him down, knocks Wise's cap off of his head, and a fist fight ensues in the shul. Okay, so a shanda and a charpa, and the police are called. So Wise realizes that his tenure at Bethel is over, but his supporters, and there was a significant number of supporters, they say, fine, we'll move across the street. We'll make our own shul. We'll call it Anshei Emes, people of truth, because it's our truth. I mean, not their truth, but it's our truth. And so for the next 4 years, Isaac Meir Wise is a rabbi of Anshei Emet on the other side of Albany. Okay? But they can't afford to pay him a big salary because it's a breakaway shul. So Wise is always politically very savvy. He was friendly with Senator Seward of New York. And the senator was able to get Isaac Meir Wise the position as Jewish chaplain for the state of New York. And that gave him a little parnassa, a salary, so they were able to afford him in the shul. At Anshei Emet, Wise instituted mixed seating, mixed pews. Why did he do it? Was it because of his women's issues concern? Possibly, but there's another factor. And that is that they were finally going to have their own building. And where they had the building, unlike in the churches, which they had rented previously, where there was a balcony for the women, because even the churches had separate galleries for the women, the new building that they were in had no upstairs. So given that there was no alternative place for the women to sit, he wasn't going to put up a machitza. So mixed pews. Sometimes just circumstances call for a change that wasn't really thought through, but it stuck. And from that point forward, a hallmark of American Reform Judaism was the mixed pew, as opposed to liberal Judaism in Germany and in most of Central Europe, where the mixed pew was a foreign idea, because by the Lutherans, it was still the case in Germany that they sat separate. So therefore, the liberal Jews also sat separate.
Okay. But American Protestants, do they sit separately or together?
So some denominations sat separately, but that basically went out of style by the mid-19th century, so that you're not going to find churches in 1880s, 1890s, 1910s America with separate pews. But you would have found them in the 1750s or the 1820s or 1830s. So there was an evolution over time, and American Reform Judaism went with that flow. Okay. So in 1853, Isaac Meir Wise wrote a history of the Israelitish nation, a history of the Jews. Bear in mind that he's not really a scholar. I mean, he may be somewhat well-read, but he's by no means an academic scholar. And so the work is not worth reading by today's standards, even by the standards of then. But he was very proud of himself. And it was really only the second or third history of the Jews that had been written in the Western world. Isaac Marcus Yost was the first one in the 1830s, and then Gretz would not get into his history of the Jews, the Geschichte der Juden, until a good 20 years later. So he's one of the earliest so-called history of the Jews. But what Isaac Meir Wise did was to eliminate the supernatural and the miraculous in the history of the Jews. So he denied the veracity of, let's say, the crossing of the Red Sea or other miracles of the Torah. Not that he would deny the stories, but he would, in sort of Ibn Ezra style, dumb down the miraculous and supernatural to the point that it was just really an understandable, irrationally understandable tale of events, of human events. So this got him into trouble. Even his own congregants at Anshei Emet were not so sure they liked this. And Wise was applying for a job in Cincinnati at B'nai Jeshurun. And he got the job, and then he released his manuscript about the history of the Jews. He understood that maybe some people in Cincinnati would be disappointed with this and think that they're hiring a heretic. And so he told them, if you would like to be released from the contract that we signed, you could be released from the contract. Which they responded, no, we want you, even though you wrote this, and we like this, or it's not a problem for us, we're going to hire you as our rabbi. So he goes to Cincinnati. It's interesting. Although Wise was willing to deny the veracity of miracles and wanted to have the history of the Jews withstand Western scrutiny and academic scrutiny, there was one doctrine that he would not give up. Even when others in the Reform movement would be dismissive of this doctrine, he would not give it up. And that is divine revelation of the Torah. Divine revelation of the Torah and Mosaic authorship of the Torah. He rejected the notion of documentary hypothesis of multiple hands of J, P, E, and D, which would be popularized by Wellhausen in the decades to follow. So maybe Wise, because he was born too soon, maybe had he lived a generation later, like his successor at Hebrew Union College, Kaufman Kohler, would have accepted documentary hypothesis, but Wise believed in the divine revelation of the Bible and Mosaic authorship of the Torah. So this had a very interesting consequence. It's not related to tonight's topic, but while I'm on the issue, in 1899, Louis Ginzburg came to America. Louis Ginzburg would go on to have an illustrious career, 50 years at the Jewish Theological Seminary as the greatest professor of Talmud in the first half of the 20th century, and a fairly traditional conservative figure in their movement, the leader of their right-wing flank. So when he came to America, he was offered a job at Hebrew Union College, 1899. And Wise, having found out that Louis Ginzburg, although he was Frum by standards of the time, and a great Talmudist, he believed in documentary hypothesis. He can't have a job at Hebrew Union College. So lo and behold, Louis Ginzburg lost Parnassa from a Reform rabbinical seminary because his theology was too far to the left, whereas at JTS, his religious practice was very far to the right. So it's very bizarre how that happened. But why Isaac Meir Wise essentially stole the academic opportunity from Louis Ginzburg. Okay, there was a question in the chat from Len Thaler. Did Lilienthal continue to support Wise? Ah, good question. So the answer to that is Lilienthal himself underwent the metamorphosis. In the early 1850s, when Lilienthal did not hold a position in any shul, he began to have reformist ideas. Whereas he began as essentially a modern Orthodox type, just wanting decorum in the shuls, he then went on to espouse real reforms. Changes of the liturgy, abolishing the second day of holidays, mixed pew, you name it. And his position as a rabbi in Cincinnati was essentially that of Wise, a Reform rabbi. So he went from being an Orthodox rabbi of a Maskilic variety to being a Reform rabbi over the span of a few years. Why did he have this change of heart? No one's 100% sure, but he had Wissenschaft training from his German days in the university, and I guess at some point the Wissenschaft kicked in. Okay, Asher is asking, traditionally organized organized life in the Jewish is looser, more experimental, coincident with the States. Americans were moving westward. Okay, so you're right. So moving westward meant that there was freedom to do whatever you wanted. And you were not encumbered by, yes, the same Ginsburg.
Especially outside of New York, you know.
Right, so the people were free to do what they wanted. And if they could find a clergy person who also was willing to tinker with the tradition, then you had a good shidduch, And it just so happens that among these newly arrived German Jewish clergymen, you had people willing to jettison old practices for people who were not interested in old practices, and it worked out nicely. Okay, so Wise gets to Cincinnati, and he wants to have a union of congregations. He wants to have a union of rabbis. He wants to have a place for the training of rabbis. These are his three goals: synagogue union, rabbinical union, seminary. Three things. In truth, Isaac Leiser had already thought of these things before, but he was unable to act on them in an earlier time because the Jewish community of America was too small, lacked the critical mass, and he didn't have anybody to collaborate with. Okay, so in 1855, there's this conference at Cleveland, and it called together the traditionalists, the moderate reformers, and maybe even potentially the radical reformers. But in order to make sure that the traditionalists were not scared off by the reformers, they agreed ahead of time to accept the divine revelation of Torah and the notion that the Talmud correctly interprets the Bible. That the Talmud correctly interprets the Bible. So that was a concession to the traditionalists, lest they be scared off. Fine. Well, this did not satisfy everyone. The really firm ones, like Illoui, and for that matter, Rice, were not interested. They understood this was a bunch of heathens and apikorsim and amaratzim, and they wanted nothing to do with it. Isaac Leiser participated only to regret it after the fact, because he realized he was snookered into something that wasn't going to bolster traditional Judaism. But it turned out that the biggest objection to the Cleveland Conference was from none other than the most radical reformer of them all, David Einhorn. David Einhorn was the rabbi in Mecklenburg-Schwerin in Germany, and then he went to Pest, like Budapest, but he was fired. The government eliminated him because they thought he was seditious. And in 1855, he came to America and became the rabbi of the Har Sinai Verein in Baltimore. Now, if you remember from a half hour ago, I said the Har Sinai was a reform congregation that was established because Abraham Rice was too frum for the people in Baltimore, and the progressives broke away. Well, for a decade and a half, they didn't have a rabbi, but now they have David Einhorn, who is espousing radical reform. No tefillin, no talis, no yarmulke, mixed pews, you name it. Okay? But he was not a reformer for convenience sake. He actually was a great thinker, a great theologian. So when he truncated the body of Judaism, it was not just because these things are inconvenient. It's because he believed that progressive Judaism was necessary for the preservation of Judaism and that it required a more refined and reformed version of religious life. Okay. The one thing that David Einhorn was, for which he was quite traditional, was intermarriage. David Einhorn believed that intermarriage was the death knell of Judaism, the nail in the coffin of Judaism. And he was right. That if you're going to strip away all the ceremonials, the practical aspects of day-to-day life, of mitzvot yom yomi, then if you're going to marry a shiksa, what's left? Nothing. So that was Einhorn's approach. Now, Einhorn wrote a prayer book, and that prayer book was known as Olat Tamid. Moshe asks, when was the term Reform Judaism first applied to an American synagogue? Well, in 1824, the Reform Society of Israelites, right away. The word reform was in the title. And it was being thrown around from the very beginning, throughout the 1830s and 40s, when a synagogue would go in a progressive direction, it was reform. The name was not a late appellation to an earlier concept. It was there from the very beginning. Okay, so what was I in the middle of saying? Olat Tamid. So why was David Einhorn's prayer book known as Olat Tamid? Seth, I see you're unmuted. You can tell me why. Why Olat Tamid? Any ideas?
No.
No ideas. Okay. Well, if you're a reformer, what's the one thing you never want to see again?
Sacrifices.
Olat Tamid. You never want to see the daily sacrifice.
Sacrifices, yeah.
The mm-hmm. temple is the new Beis HaMikdash. The synagogue temple is the successor to the Beit HaMikdash, and the liturgy, the Motzah Sfatecha, Hashem Sfatai Tivtach, the word of your lips, of your mouth, that's going to replace the Parim, the bulls, the bullocks, and so therefore Olat Tamid is going to be done how? With words, by your voice, by uttering prayers. And so his liturgy is Olat Tamid. So he's competing with Merzbacher's Seder Tefillah. But neither one of those won the day, because the winner in everything is always going to be Isaac Meir Wise. He's the big head honcho. What does he do? After the Cleveland Conference, he has like a subcommittee on the prayer book where he declares himself to be the head of that committee. And he puts out his own prayer book. And what does he title the prayer book? Minhag America.
Oh.
You have Minhag Poland, you have Minhag Ashkenaz, Minhag Sfard, Minhag America. And who made it up? Isaac Meir Wise. The chutzpah of him, he thinks he's the boss of American Jewry. And by the way, he spelled America with a K. All right, so Minhag America was not at nearly as radical as Olat Tamid was, meaning there was more Hebrew and less English, because at least at that point, Wise was not a thoroughgoing reformer. He still wanted to hold on to some traditional congregants who would be offended if there was an insufficient amount of Hebrew. Okay, so the Olat Tamid was a success insofar as Wise had a lot of customers. The book sold very well in the congregations in the American South and the American West, the frontier, and, you know, the Central Time Zone and the South. Why did it do well in those places? So very simple, because Isaac Meir Wise understood the power of the media, of the press, and he established a newspaper. So whereas the Occident from Leiser was once a month, it was a sort of like a highbrow literary magazine that had a lot of important information in it. The Israelite was once a week, and it was more for the Hamonam. It was news and not as sophisticated. In 1874, the name of the paper would be changed from the Israelite to the American Israelite, because Wise understood another thing. He understood that he had to be a cheerleader for America. Always America, America, America. Assimilation, assimilation. It's good. It's good to be American. Don't be dismissive of America, and don't poo-poo acculturation. American Israelite. Okay, Minhag America. That was his thing. He always emphasized America. By the way, and we're going to have to discuss this at some length over the next few weeks with the Civil War, Wise also understood that his constituency was largely a Southern constituency and a pro-slavery one. So Wise was not a Republican, although he lives in basically a border state of Ohio. He's a Democrat. And he's a little wishy-washy on slavery. He's not an abolitionist. He was not in favor of chattel slavery in the American South, but he never called for its abolition. And so he was able to sustain a good relationship with Jewish communities in the Confederacy, even before the Civil War, in the Southern states where, you know, differing attitudes, he could have alienated them. He chose not to as a savvy move. Okay. Another thing that he had wanted to do was to establish a place of learning for the training of rabbis. But that's impossible. You don't even have secondary Jewish education, anything beyond elementary level, where kids study Torah and rabbinic literature. So he decided to establish Zion College. And in 1855, within a year of him coming to Cincinnati, he sold subscriptions to Zion College, a scholarship fund all around the country through his newspaper, and the money came flowing in, and he established, it was like a high school, so-called Zion College. It had 13 students, and it folded within a year. It was too soon. Who wanted to send their kid to Cincinnati to study Torah, to study even Judaism? It was too soon. It was a failed attempt, as would Leiser's attempt a decade and a half later with Maimonides College in Philadelphia. There would not be a successful attempt until 1875 with the establishment of Hebrew Union College. So, even before the Civil War then, We find that Wise is an operator, a savvy operator at that, with his tentacles all over the place, trying to have school, synagogue union, and rabbinical union. And we'll find success in all three areas after the Civil War. But we also find that there's now ill will between the East and the West, that whereas in the West, you have moderate reform along the lines of Wise and Lilienthal. In the East, you have radical reform along the lines of Einhorn and then later Samuel Adler and Samuel Hirsch, who come from Germany, from Luxembourg. And you also have the traditionalists, the ones who are still Orthodox. So you have the Frum and the crazy heretical in the East, and you have the moderate reformers in the West. And the two camps have to somehow be bridged in order for national Jewish institutions to get off the ground. Okay. Just a few more points about the pre-Civil War era. You do have the establishment of Eastern European congregations starting in the 1850s, because not everybody who's the non-Sephardi is actually German or Central European. And so in New York, you're going to have congregations that are Russian Jewish congregations or Polish Jewish congregations on the Lower East Side, and they're going to hire their own rabbis, and some of them are going to arrive in the 1850s, 1860s, and these fellows are going to have nothing to do with the more Americanized kehilot of the Sephardic and German variety. What about the average synagogue on the frontier, in the South, even in the North? What's happening? Right after the Civil War, there were probably about 200 synagogues in America. So meaning before the Civil War, maybe they were 100 or something. Very few of them were actually reform before the Civil War, in the sense of having adopted anti-halachic changes for ideological reasons. But many were inching in that direction, and after the war, they would make the jump. And so synagogues are not safe. Just because now, let's say in 1850 or 1855 or 1857, it has a certain style of observance, it's not to say that a year later or 5 years later, it's going to maintain that. There's tremendous change afoot, more so than at any other time in American Jewish history. The jump from the German immigrant synagogue to the Reform synagogue. Okay, there was a question in the chat. Why the unnecessary confusion using Jewish as a first to Israelite, confusing the national physical identity? Okay, so the answer is, in America, there was a strong preference to use the term Israelite rather than Jew, because Jew is a dirty word, has a negative connotation. It also has a certain rabbinic connotation as opposed to Israelite, which is a biblical connotation. And in America, they love the Bible. So if you want to blend in America, you want to be a biblical religion. And so we are the biological descendants of the Israelites. That's a wonderful thing, biological Israel, as opposed to Jew, which means like detested for killing Jesus or rejecting Christ. Okay, what about Moshe says, for someone who seemed to accomplish so much liturgy, education, why is he so disliked? You're referring to Isaac Meir Wise? Okay, so the answer is that Wise was very well liked by his own people and by communities all around the United States who were going reform. And most of them were. So he was seen as a leader in the vanguard of this movement. And he was a great institution builder, as we shall see in the post-war era. So I can understand why a Jew who doesn't have Orthodox scruples would see Wise as a great man. However, for those who have traditional preferences and who now know the rest of the story, that Reform Judaism did not remain moderate, but rather went aggressively anti-tradition in the post-Civil War era, including eating treif and sometimes Shabbos on Sunday and the like. So for those people, Wise comes across as a charlatan. The guy was a phony. He had no credentials, passed himself off as some sort of authority, and radically transformed Judaism into something that it shouldn't be, and got away with it. And became a lionized hero of the vast bulk of the American Jewish community prior to 1881 and the arrival of the Eastern European types. So that's why, for posterity, people like me have an axe to grind against Isaac Mayer Wise. Okay, we'll stop here. And next week, we're going to discuss what the attitudes were of some of the big rabbis towards slavery in the pre-Civil War era, leading up to the Civil War.
Yom Kippur.
So not next week. In 2 weeks, Chol HaMoed Sukkos. So 2 weeks from now, we'll discuss the attitude of the rabbis towards slavery. And then the week after that, we'll discuss what happened to Jewish communities during the Civil War, including General Order Number 11 of General Grant. Okay, see everybody in 2 weeks. Gemar Chasima Tova to one and all.
Is there any connection
with Isaac Mayer Wise and Stephen Wise?
Shana Tova.
There's no relation between Isaac Mayer Wise and Stephen Wise. No relation. Okay, take care, everybody.